know one of the best-selling books in the 90s? This is after Mosaic. It was a book in the bookstore, How to Get on the Internet. You had to download drivers and Windows. That's, what, of course, why AOL became popular. They literally said, finally, it's so hard, we're going to send you CDs because this is just a nightmare. Because you had to literally go and be like a hacker just to install the Windows drivers.
I realized email marketing was going to be big. And in 1997, every human that walked into the wine library that bought Sirius Wine, I was like, would you like to join our email newsletter? Half of them didn't know what email was. The remaining 25%, there was 25% that knew, would say something like, yeah, my email is AOL at yahoo.com. Like they didn't have it calibrated. Yeah. Attention is the number one asset. Vayner Nation, how are you? Very excited about this interview. As you know, most of what I'm doing is group settings and podcasts in 2024, podcasts with friends that I stream live on Twitch. Go to Twitch, go to GaryVee.com/Twitch. All of you should be subbing up. But this one's a special episode because I think a lot about filming myself over the last 15, 20 years. And something happened when I was with a couple of buddies on my team a couple of months ago where we looked back at old footage from my daily vlog, even just 6, 7 years ago. And I already got what I wanted out of this, which was the fondness of looking back at things. Yeah. I'm making a prediction that I will look at this interview in 30, 40, 50 years with incredible fondness. And so I'm glad that I still look somewhat decent because I have a feeling this will be an important video that I watch and my grandkids watch. My guest today is Chris Dixon. He wrote a new book and it's an important book, Read, Write, Own. Chris is someone I've gotten to know a lot better in the last 3, 4 years. But when that started happening, when we started talking and he's got an incredible career as a founder and definitely as an investor, it was really funny when I could tell that, like, oh, I feel like Chris and I are going to get closer. I called AJ and I said, bro, guess who I've been talking to a little bit lately? And he said, who? I said, Chris Dixon. And he laughed with a laugh that you can only know when you have a brother, which was he knew why it mattered to me. I navigated 2006 to 2011 as an essential point in my career. It's when I transitioned from running a liquor store to starting to become an angel investor. And really my talk about your, you know, to me that was like going away to college, that era of the internet. I really became dramatically more educated on many things. And it was also during an era where a lot of the people from 2003, 4, 5 were writing blogs, and blogs were such an essential part of the internet. And then Twitter came along and things started to shift. But I consumed an enormous amount of information from so many different people in that 5-year window. And literally, there was only a couple people that consistently would say things. And I'm like, yep. And as you can imagine, because I felt that I had a good eye on where the world was going, that made me think that they were smart. I agreed. And obviously it all kind of, a lot of those things played out. Chris, literally, one of two or three people that I was like, wow, this guy gets it. And when I found myself getting deeper and deeper into Web3, sure enough, he was there again and again, gets it. So it's a real honor for me, Chris, to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much, Gary.
My audience knows that setup is unheard of for me. And so I think we better not blow it now.
Yeah.
big trouble. We got to fill those shoes.
And likewise, like, you know, I think of you as one of the kind of fellow travelers who have been through multiple eras of the internet and have always been, I think, optimistic, embracing new technologies, leaning into it. And I have a lot of respect for that. And so I was excited when I, you know, when we got the chance formally.
Because it was very, afar, I mean, conferences here and there.
Yeah, it had been informal before. So I was very excited to get to work with you formally.
And that sets up this whole thing. Let me just go right into it. We filmed this a little bit earlier, but like this is out now on podcast, in all my socials, clips. We're pushing it today because it's release day, January 30th. I couldn't recommend more, especially because so many of you have been V Friends or V Friends Curious. Crypto or crypto curious, NFT, this, blockchain, that, deep fake videos. Like, I know who's listening, all the way from the kids on the come up who are excited about it to all of, I probably want the Fortune 500, the policymakers, the small business owners to read this even more. This book has the potential, again, no pressure, has the potential to be the quintessential book that allowed people to get it. The aha as we transition from Web 2 to Web 3. There's so much you know, not misinformation, there's so much misunderstanding of this next era. I think Chris has done a phenomenal job at taking a stab at it. And so, again, the reason I said that I might look back on this fondly is I think it'll be fun to look at. I know we'll be friends in 40 years and we'll be like, we had hair. And I have a feeling like this book could be that book. And so it's an important time too, because I do think right now we're in an inflection point of people trying to understand this fully, but are ready to understand it. So very simply, my first and maybe only question, because I think we can rant on this and flow, is why did you write this book now? And what is the book about?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been spent my whole career on the internet. I basically 25 years working on the internet in some way or another. I was an entrepreneur. I started two companies and then became an investor.
Tell everybody what those companies
are. Yeah. So, and just going back, by the way, like I was just my own background, like I came from Ohio. My parents were professors. I was actually in a PhD program in philosophy, believe it or not.
I think most of the reasons I've always head nodded with you is I think you understand human behavior. That makes a lot of sense.
And that was sort of late 90s. And then I discovered, for me, it was a real, real kind of epiphany, was to discover that there was a job you could do, which was to, you know, like start companies and do this cool stuff. And then specifically on the internet. And for me, what was attractive about the internet, for those who kind of know the internet history, and I go through some of this in the book, is the idea that it would be this network that connects all the computers and all the people in the world, but it would be a network owned by the people, right? Yes. It would be democratically controlled. Right.
That was the original internet.
And the idea, anyone could go and put up a website. You could be an artist, a poet, a programmer, an entrepreneur, whatever you want to do. And you could put up a website and you could go and build an audience and have a direct relationship with that audience. And maybe that's something you do for fun, or maybe you put ads up or you sell products. But whatever you want to do, you can do. And you have this little plot of land, your website. You know, Amazon.com became a very big plot of land. Some of these little plots of land became big. I have a little plot of land, cdixon.org. But you got a little plot of land, right? You got a little plot of land and you could build on it. And you knew if you built on it that you would own it, right? That you would own what you built. So, you know, Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and Larry Page and all these people who were building these startups, and I believe a lot of the entrepreneurship that led to the original kind of growth of the internet was because people were attracted to that promise.
100%.
Right?
I told my father that winelibrary.com, which I launched in 1997 for a single store liquor store in New Jersey, was going to be our second location.
Yep.
We were going to own this store.
And you owned it, right? You owned that website. And there's a whole history to that, how that happened, like that architecture of the internet. It came out of government and academia. I go through it briefly in the book. I go through the kind of important points. Yes. I try not to bog it down with too much history, but
that's been well covered too.
Yeah, but I go through the sort of salient points, and specifically, it was architected in a way that you sort of owned, you had ownership, and specifically like of your domain or of your email address, and that gave you all these rights and let you build a direct audience, and that was a very important sort of what seems like a kind of arcane technical feature that you could own your domain. And that, for example, if your hosting provider misbehaves, you can switch your domain to somebody else. You control it, right? And that's a very important feature.
Point.
That basically shifted power to the edges of the network, to the users, the creators, and the entrepreneurs. And so that was great. And then, you know, the internet sort of continued to grow. You know, obviously there was the internet bubble and then crash in the 2000s. And then kind of, I think when you got involved and I was involved then too, that was sort of the kind of rebirth, the Web 2 era, right? Yes. And that's when people started to realize that the internet wouldn't, so in the sort of first era, most of the websites were I call it skeuomorphic. It's a term that Steve Jobs used to refer to software that kind of looks like old fashioned things, like the original Apple app had sort of grainy book looks and stuff. That was a Steve Jobs term. But it's come to mean something broader, which is sort of when a new medium pops up, like the internet, people do things like they take magazines and brochures and basically make digital versions of
them,
right? And that was kind of, you know, I think probably most
of
your listeners...
We always take the last form factor into the new.
Like early films were plays, essentially.
That's right. We're at VaynerMedia, an advertising firm.
Yeah.
The first 100 TV commercials were radio ads.
Yep.
A man sat there in red.
So you always sort of port the last form of media. So right. So the web.
By the way, if I may, I apologize.
Yeah, yeah.
It's why social media marketing is misunderstood. You still have TV-centric advertising agencies trying to make ads on social media that are made for television. That's why all those YouTube commercials stink. They shouldn't be that. They should be YouTube pre-roll ads, not a television commercial run as a pre-roll.
Yeah, and that's a repeating pattern, right? So whenever Correct. Something new comes along, this is sort of, you go do like media studies yep. and read like Marshall McLuhan, these kinds of people, they'll talk about it, which is a new medium comes, new form of media comes along, and people start off sort of doing the last thing. And then there's a few people like you who are kind of pioneers, but then eventually other people figure it out.
That's right.
And the specific new thing you could do with the internet in the 2000s was, it was a two-way, it was a publishing medium. It wasn't just, it was, that's why I call it read. It was, it's the first one was sort of read only, you're consuming information. In the 2000s, in the Web 2 movement, people said, hey, what about if anyone can not only read, but they can write, they can publish, right? And that was the beginning of blogging in the early 2000s. I mean, there was some blogging, but yep. really in earnest, it began
there
in
was,
the 2000s.
There was a popular news site, as you remember, called Read, Write, Web.
There was. Yeah. In fact, I quoted in the book.
Yeah.
And their first thing, actually, I quote their first paragraph, which was, the web should be more than about, it was like 2003, they put up a manifesto. The web should be more than about reading information. It should be about reading and writing.
I love it.
And in fact, the other name for Web 2, there were conferences, the Read, Write, they were called
Read,
Write.
Yeah. I mean, spoke at one.
So this is not, by the way, some people ask me, like, Read, Write, did you make it?
No.
Read, Write's an old term.
Yeah.
The own is the sort of new part. And
that's
so
right.
anyways, but that's where the title comes from. But so then the internet kind of grew, and that was great. But then the way I think about it is, it was sort of a battle in the late 2000s between, when social networking got big, between open and closed architectures. And so open specifically, there was a protocol called RSS. And people still use it for podcasting and stuff. And it's still around, but it's like, you know, tens of millions of users, not billions of users, the way that Facebook has. Right. And so what happened essentially,
and the way that a lot of us thought it could get to.
Yeah. And so at one point it was sort of a legitimate rival to Twitter and Facebook and everything
yep.
else. And then around, you know, 2010-ish, the corporate owned networks, the sort of proprietary networks like Facebook and Twitter, started to pull ahead. Fast forward today, you know, that they're now dominant. And fast forward today, you now have you know, the top 1% of social networks control 95% of the traffic. Top 1% of search engines, 95% of the search traffic. The, you know, NASDAQ, the top five tech companies went from 25% of the NASDAQ market cap 10 years ago to 50% today.
Wow.
Like, so all of these stats.
Real consolidation.
Yeah, it's just massive consolidation. And my concern, and I think we're really headed there, is the internet's going to end up like old broadcast TV, where you're going to have ABC, CBS, and NBC. You're going to have, you know, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, and like five things. And you're already seeing this, by the way, like, you know, Twitter's demoting if you link out. Like, you're not only going to have five things, but they're going to be completely closed silos. And there's going to be...
These organisms are going to care about themselves.
They're going to care about themselves. And so this... The internet will have gone from what I think of as this sort of beautiful open dream of like this democratic internet into what I think is really not a great outcome, which is an internet of, you know, sort of four or five companies that have full control. And specifically, why is it not a good outcome? I think it's not a good outcome because, for example, for creators, okay, if you're a creator right now and you create, you know, why do you wake up in the morning and go to TikTok and Instagram, right? You go there not because of the content that TikTok and Instagram produce, but because of the content that users produce, right? And so how does TikTok make money? They make money through advertising. They take all of the money they make from advertising. They have very de minimis creator funds, but they're like less than 1% of their revenue. But outside of that, they take all the money. And so they make it very hard, you know, music, Spotify, it's a great service. By the way, I love all these services. They're great. But, you know, musicians, of the 8 million musicians on Spotify, 14,000 make $50,000 a year or more, which is roughly the average American salary, and the rest don't. And so this architecture of consolidating power in these five companies is bad for, for creative people.
Why do you think the consumer at scale as a herd allowed that to happen?
I think they created better experiences, frankly. I think things like RSS were, you remember this, they were clunky. You had to set up your own domain. You had to...
friction.
Yeah, and also, by the way, I talk about this in the book, I got through it. Like, I used YouTube as a case study. They did heavy subsidization. So the original value proposition of YouTube in 2005 when they launched was, you get to, it's really easy to host video, and by the way, it's free because we'll pay for it.
Yeah.
And they raised billions of dollars of venture capital and subsidized it.
By the way, I wanted to launch Wine Library TV 3 years before I did. I went to my tech team and said, I want to make wine videos. They're like, okay. I'm like, tell me how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
They said, okay. They came back and they said, for every 15-minute video you put up, because that was my guess of how long it would take me, they're like, for every 100 people that are going to watch it, it was some aspirin. I was like, what?
And that's what you had to do if you used RSS.
That's right.
Right. So that's why so what happened is venture capital, the industry I work in,
came
along and said, hey, you know what? We think this will be so valuable someday. And YouTube today, by the way, Wall Street Analyst is part of Google, but Wall Street Analysts say it's worth $140 billion.
Right.
And so the VCs correctly said, someday the prize is so big that
let's
give you, let's call it $10 billion to subsidize it,
yep.
beat RSS, and then eventually it'll be worth $140 billion. That was sort of the calculation the VCs of that era made, and you know, correctly. A lot yeah. of them did very well.
Yeah.
These are very valuable. You know, Meta's worth whatever, yeah. I don't know, $700 billion or something.
I also think the thing that I knew,
yeah.
which is why I bet the farm on social, was attention is the asset.
Mm-hmm.
And when That's you're right. when you're on GaryVaynerchuk.com, you have to muster up the demand all by yourself. When you are on twitter.com/GaryV, you're getting by accident awareness.
That's right.
All these creators that come to me and they're like, I hate the platforms. I'm like, you were zero in your living room.
Yep.
You went on and you made content and you paid zero for a whip. When you advertise to get people to know about something, you pay.
Yep.
And that was so valuable yeah. that it created the consolidation.
Yeah. Yeah, I call it come for the tool, stay for the network is sort of yeah. the pattern I call it. So you start, come for the tool. YouTube says, meaning it's sort of a single, like, hey, you come there because they subsidize it and it's an easy to do video.
And to me,
but then over time,
yeah,
it's because
it.
Of the distribution.
And to me, my interpretation is come for the attention, stay for the attention.
Yeah.
You know, you come because you want to get that awareness.
Yeah.
To your point, when you become Beyonce, you don't need it as much. But the reality is more and more of the attention is still there. And so like all of a sudden, even traditional media can't rival that level of attention. So being on the cover of People magazine and being on Today Show and being on primetime special on NBC is not going to outpace contemporary attention from having incredible success on TikTok.
Yeah.
Anyway, nonetheless, go ahead.
So, okay, so that's sort of the problem yes. statement, what I said. You know, so the internet started off as this dream of this democratic...
Yeah, and it's funny, I if I may.
Yeah.
I actually, when I hear you say this, don't think that you think it's this catastrophic problem. I think you think of it as it can just be better.
Yeah.
That
look,
is always,
I love, look,
right?
I love the internet. I obviously, yep. like the average American uses yep. 7 hours a day. I'm probably at that or above. Like, I think it's incredibly valuable, incredibly useful. I've built my career on it. It's been great for me. And so.
It's just not as great as it can be.
Yeah, I think it can be, I think it can be much better.
That.
Yes, yes. And I think that. And my favorite way to make it better is through innovation, as opposed to, let's say, regulation or something like this. Like, there's one school of thought.
This is why I love you versus despise you.
Well, that one school of thought would be, hey, this is too big. Let's do things like block acquisitions. And first of all, the cat's out of the bag. These companies are already huge. Blocking new acquisitions is not going to, I don't think it's going to move the needle. You know, maybe you could break them up. It's very hard
and
to
you
imagine
know
how you could do
the
that.
The real game is based on what is perceived. As, you know, the real game is new features, stories,
yeah.
in stream, this. But the reality is the speed in which the big players can copy a feature, Be Real, right? Snapchat, like these, you know, Snapchat got fortunate
yeah.
that it took Meta so long to create the story yeah. function in Instagram. If they had done it 2 years earlier.
Yep. Yeah, look, and I also think, by the way, and I also think it's a business opportunity. If you can go, so, you know, getting to blockchains, mm-hmm. like what I see as a blockchain is a... It's a piece of infrastructure that lets you build new digital services in which those digital services enable direct relationships between creators, startups, developers, and their audiences.
Yes.
So, for example, what you do with VFriends.
That's like right.
When you sell a VFriend, a collectible, to your audience, you pay maybe a small 2%, 2.5% fee to a marketplace or something,
yep.
but otherwise that money goes to you. That 97%, let's call it, of yep. the money going to you is unheard of in the existing.
It's the reverse.
It's
and even flip. Not even close, actually. They don't get too
much. And so yeah. it's also a business opportunity.
That's
if
right.
you can go and create new networks, new services, that you can go to these creators and say, hey, do you want 97% of the money or do you want 0% of the money? Like, it's an interesting business proposal.
You like that one? Yeah, it's not a very, yes.
So, right, I mean, that's ultimately a lot of the business proposal. So blockchains are a new way to create digital services that compete with things like, you know, Facebook and Twitter and games and just, I think, of every kind of financial services, payment
all
networks,
of
all of them. It's a new way to create digital services.
Chris, you sit here tonight, as I do, I assume, that it's inconceivable to you that in the next 20 years that one of, if not the biggest social network in the world is a decentralized social network, yes?
I bet my whole...
Yeah, me too. I mean,
so
I
do believe it, but...
Yeah.
And like I started to sort of see it, and I've been now in the space for 10 years, started to see, like, to me around 2013 or 14 was when we started to see that consolidation, when blockchain started to get more sophisticated and like the technology started to evolve. So look, these things can take a long time, and obviously
that's been the biggest thing. This is what's nice about being in this part of our career.
Yeah.
You know, when we were looking at this stuff in 96, 90s, I remember saying silly things like, I was a kid, Dad, by the year 2000, everyone's gonna buy every bottle of wine on the internet. This was lack of experience. You didn't. You could see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, one day.
It takes a long time.
But yeah, that's the.
It takes a long time to both build these products, the infrastructure, like AI. So the first paper on neural networks is 1943.
Say that one more time, really slow.
Sorry.
Because I'm not saying I'm doing this for effect.
Okay.
You're more than appropriate with your speed.
I'm trying to keep up with Gary Vee.
No, you're perfect
here.
On your speed. I'm saying this for effect.
Okay.
Because obviously this is on everyone's mind. Say it one more time for the kids in the back. The first time AI was referenced in paper.
The neural networks were invented in 1943. It was McCulloch and Pitts. It was a famous paper. You know, Alan Turing, his famous Turing test was 1950, his paper. He even then predicted like 20 years from now. Well, I forgot exactly his predictions were, but very sophisticated AI systems. There was an AI bubble people talk about in the 1980s with so-called expert systems. I started an AI company called Hunch in 2008, which I sold to eBay in 2011, which I thought I was like timing it right. I was 10 years too early. And you know what actually made AI happen? There were a lot of things that made AI happen, including just brilliant people designing algorithms and other things. But the real thing that made it happen were GPUs. Which are the processors that it runs on. And by the way, why did GPUs get so good? Because of video games. So like the real, underappreciated story that video games are going to bring us, advanced artificial intelligence.
Do you know why we call them bugs when there's an issue?
There was literal bugs in the vacuum tubes.
It was
Grace Hopper, I think, who coined it.
I can't believe, I just stumbled on that. I don't know how I missed it in the last 20 years. The fact that computer in Harvard in 1948 or whatever it was, they went in and something was wrong and there was a moth in there and they had to pull it out.
Did you ever see those pictures? They had those big glass vacuum tubes and
insane that is?
Those things were like, they were like, I think they had...
By the way, as I've gotten more...
1K of memory or something, people don't even know what that means
anymore. That's kind of why I jumped in, just to sidetrack to talk about something interesting. Lately, because what's going on, because I'm aware about the GPUs and like the firepower, right?
Yeah.
The firepower. I'm trying to figure out now I'm getting fascinated by that. I'm like, okay, what happens when it 100x is now? What can we do that is like, that's where it gets fun.
With AI?
No, with something else that I can't see right now.
Oh,
Space travel, living underwater, robot, I don't know.
Yeah,
things are above my pay grade. I'm good at consumer behavior with emerging technologies. Yeah. The hardcore tech's just a different level.
No, and I think it's going to continue. A lot of these things are economic phenomenons, meaning that like GPUs were already getting better. Like, why did GPUs get better? Part of it is physics and smart people.
Yes.
But they needed the money, and they had the money because of video games.
Yes.
Now they have a lot more money because of AI, and so they're going to get even better and better.
That makes
sense. And so like, there's this flywheels that kick in, right?
Yes.
And they're really, I think primarily, people talk about Moore's Law.
Yes.
And that's important, but that's sort of how many, generally refers to how many transistors, Dennard scaling is called, how many transistors can you pack onto it, like smaller and smaller area. But really, there's this broader thing that happens across networking, storage, all areas of computing, just the connectivity. And that's an economic phenomenon. Why is your iPhone so amazing today? It's partly because the iPhone's gotten better. It's partly because the apps have gotten better. But the two reinforced each other, right? It's because the first iPhone came out, somebody created Snap and Uber, and the entrepreneurs created these services. The services became popular. That then gave Apple, sold more phones.
Of course.
Gave them more money. They went out and made a better 100%. Camera. That made Instagram
especially
better.
Especially when you're taking a 30%
break. It's all these flywheels. And we're in a flywheel with AI. I believe we're in a flywheel with blockchains now. Blockchains are getting better. The apps are getting better. The infrastructure is getting better. They have a natural network effect. The more people that use.
What's the biggest thing that people are missing about this blockchain phenomenon public that's a little bit more educated? Not somebody who has no, but what do you think is
right?
Well,
I think that there's some self-inflicted wounds here due to the crypto industry, which is the kind of speculative and casino aspects.
Yes.
I have a part in the book where I call it the casino versus the computer.
Mm.
And so the idea is that there's sort of two cultures, right?
Yeah.
There's the culture, which I write about. I hope this will be the book people reference when they think about the productive uses of blockchains. The blockchains that, how do you use blockchains to create new internet services that provide a better internet than the one we have today? That's an internet that rewards creators and developers. That's the productive vision that I write about. There's another set of people who I think have taken, like, tokens are an important part of this.
Yes.
NFTs, tokens like Ethereum that help power these computers. Ethereum is a computer in the sky that nobody owns and anyone can access.
Right.
And it's powered, it has to fund itself. Remember I was talking about subsidies of YouTube. They don't have external sources of funding, so it funded itself through the token. So the token plays a productive use in the system. But there's a set of people who have taken these tokens out of these contexts, and like SBF and FTX would be the extreme example, yep. put it on a website and make it into a gambling thing.
Yep.
And that gets all this media attention. There's scams and fraud. Yep. Yep. And then that just kind of really, really sullies the image waters. Of the space.
That's right.
And look, and some of this is, you know, I think is self-inflicted. There are people that, you know, that I know that are, you know, people get excited by trading and this and stuff. There's nothing wrong with speculating and things.
It's the same thing like Wall Street, right? Like there's like, it's, what about alcohol? If you misuse something.
And like Wall Street, like, look, the real purpose of the stock market is to provide efficient allocation of capital to help companies build products.
That's right.
A byproduct of that is you have hedge funds and speculation. And that does play an important role. I'm not anti like trading.
Of
right?
course not.
Like trading plays a role. It plays a role in price discovery and liquidity and other things.
You're in.
But in crypto, I think we put the cart before the horse.
Yes.
Right. We mix the two. Like,
well, it happened with Web 1. It was just done with the stock prices.
Yeah, that's right. Web 1 had its own
version. It had its own version. It was just, it wasn't full consumer like we are now.
Yeah.
But like,
well, it was full consumer. I mean,
what I mean by that was in 1997, the friction to buy 30 shares of pet.com, that was infinite, like, there was too much friction.
But it was happening. I mean, that wave, that financial wave was,
I remember.
Was retail driven in the 90s. That's,
yes, it was, right? E-Trade, right?
Oh, yeah. There was ads every minute on 100%. TV about trading and very similar. I think that kind of casino culture has really sullied the blockchain kind of movement.
Right, the general, definitely NFTs.
Yeah.
You know, I do think Bitcoin is, as a brand, is doing well in the scheme of things. Yeah. Definitely NFTs.
Yeah.
But more importantly, even if NFTs and every cryptocurrency had a great brand right this second, I still think the majority of people don't even understand the underlying aspects of the blockchain and how profound it will be for proof.
Well, and this is partly why I wrote the book, right? Because I've been in the space for 10 years. I've had God knows how many conversations I'm trying to talk about this. Like
you wrote this mainly for yourself. You're like, here, just read this, right? Like instead of all
just,
this.
You just like, look, I'm, by the way, for the listeners, like I have been a longtime proponent of blog. I blogged for years.
Yes.
I've been a longtime believer that like most business books shouldn't be books. They should be blog posts. Okay. Just so you know, like I wrote a book.
I know that.
I wrote a book begrudgingly because I really feel, and by the way, this is 230 pages. I cut out another 250 pages. Like I wrote a book that begrudgingly because meaning that it's the only way I decided to really properly explain this topic. This is a topic that you just need the history of the internet. You need some context. I think there's really no other way to explain this fully and properly
It's the only reason I understand it.
So
I could not even comprehend understanding it if you don't understand the history.
Yeah.
Of the
and so I think
that's
just
why
like,
when you told me, I was like, yeah, I mean, that's, yeah.
And the first couple chapters are like a really quick run through the history of the internet. And they are basically what I would say is people like Gary, people like me, people like my partners at the senior, you know, like Mark Andreessen and other people I work with, like they would know this already. It's sort of taken for granted that these basic things I kind of argue that like.
Yeah, like when you invent the browser, like literally you had to be a super nerd by my standards in high school to know how to go on the internet before there was a browser.
Yeah.
Like normal people were like, I can't write code.
Telnet.
What are you talking about? 1-0. They're like, eBay.com, enter? Yes, understand. 12794? Like, no.
Yeah.
No, that's really? Right, yeah. That's real talk. Yeah. Yeah. I know it sounds ludicrous, but like when I was in high school and I heard of like some kid had a modem and it was like literally the most nerdy, sophisticated, knowledgeable kid in our school.
Even for, you know, one of the best-selling books in the 90s, this is after Mosaic, it was a book in the bookstore, How to Get on the Internet.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because it was like, you had to download drivers and Windows. That's what, of course, why AOL became popular. They literally said, finally, it's so hard, we're going to send you CDs. Because this is just a nightmare. Because you had to literally go and be like a hacker just to install the Windows drivers.
I realized email marketing was going to be big.
Yeah.
And in 1997, every human that walked into the wine library that bought Sirius Wine, I was like, would you like to join our email newsletter? Half of them didn't know what email was. And 25% of the remaining 25%, there was 25% that knew, would say something like, yeah, my email is AOL@yahoo.com. Like they didn't have it calibrated.
Yeah, they didn't the know,
only
like,
reason
the
was, by the way, the only reason 25% knew is by being in Short Hills, Milburn, New Jersey, I had a lot of guys and gals that worked in the stock market. And they were the ones that actually knew their email.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
It's profound. And that's where we are now. The amount of people that say the silliest thing, the same way I joke about AOL at yahoo.com and we all laugh, the things people are saying now about NFTs, crypto, hot takes not grounded in knowledge is why a book is needed.
Yeah, and look, to take NFTs is a little bit, since that's what you're working in. Like NFTs are, so the way I think of an NFT is, and I have a whole section in the book if people are interested, but the NFT is, so one of the key things that blockchains enable is they enable ownership. That's why the book's called Read, Write, Own. They allow new services to be created where the users and creators and software developers can have their little plot of land again, okay? And an NFT is essentially a little plot of land, right? Yes. It's a little thing you can own. And it's a very, you can put anything on that plot of land. Now, it so happened that NFTs, by the way, the standard wasn't finalized until 2020. So this is a four-year-old technology, just for people to know. So it's really early. And what happens often with technologies, like say the social networking, for example, is there's sort of the essence of the technology, like what it will be long-term, and then there's the way it arrives. So like early social networking, right? What was Twitter really? Today we know what Twitter really is. It's a global messaging system that you can talk about politics and culture and business. When it arrived, it was nerds talking about the burrito they had at lunch, 100%. Right? And it was widely kind of derided and mocked in, like, let's call it 2006, 2007.
That was whole career.
No, I mean, it was and by the way, my first, if you go back and look at our early tweets, we probably were nerds talking about what we had for lunch. Like, it was actually an accurate characterization.
But there was also another insight. People literally would joke to me because I was very bullish on it. I was an early investor in it.
Yeah.
I said, they're like, who cares if you're walking the dog? And my answer used to be everyone.
Yeah.
There is another thing. Like, yes, you could talk about politics and this, but people are interested in people.
Yeah.
Like right now, someone's posting walking the dog and people are replying like, what kind of breed? That's cool.
And your argument was don't confuse like the early adopters.
Correct.
With like, don't over rotate on who the first people, just because they're a bunch of nerds
in
San Francisco.
By the way, look at Instagram. Instagram was for photography.
Yeah.
Like these things take on lives of their own.
Yeah, and then as they grow, they kind of grow into what they really are. And so what NFTs really are, it's a way for you to have to create something. It can be anything. It could be a collectible item. It could be something.
It could be a wedding certificate.
It could be something, yes, that ties to the kind of real world. Uh-huh. It could be an asset in a video game. Yep. It could be an identifier on a social network. So instead of being C. Dixon on Twitter, I own my own. Uh-huh. It can be anything. And it's a general technology. It's an atomic unit of ownership is what an NFT is. And so a lot of people that are negative about it today, they look at some of the things that happened in 2021, 2022, and some of the ridiculous prices and other kinds of things. And they say, this must be a ridiculous technology. But of course, what I would argue is they should look past that and look at what it really is and what it could become. Right.
And what it's going to become.
I think it's an incredibly, like the idea
the fact
of
that you could own something and nobody can forge it. Nobody can touch it. It can't burn down in a house. You know how much paper was lost in fires and really screwed up a human? How many people lost their safety deposit box key? Like real stuff.
And do we really think in 20 years...
I don't like schlepping around my passport. I'm scared every time I'm with it.
And do we really think in 20 years that people will be, collecting physical things
the way that they do?
I mean, that'll still exist, but of course, things are going to become more and more digital.
I did a podcast yesterday called The Retirement Home. So six 80-year-old individuals interviewed me.
Yeah.
And I make all my predictions, aka quick actions, based on history.
Yeah.
Hence what we're talking about here. And I talked to them about when the credit card started to really penetrate culture.
That's funny. What'd they say?
No, they just said, you're right. Basically, it was one big... Actually, Dustin walked in the elevator and was like, what do you think? Because he knows I've been dying to get more time with people in their 80s.
Yeah.
And his answer was interesting. He said to me, it was cool to know your stuff is... what did you say? That your stuff...
It confirmed the things that you've been saying.
The stuff he's been listening to me yap about for 5 years... He doesn't have the context for, nor when he looks at me, he's like, why do you know that? Or why do you think you didn't live it? Here are people who lived it. And when you could see people's body, when I was like, hey gang, tell these kids what it was like when the credit card came out and you were like, no way am I gonna use this. What is that even? And they were like, yeah. And how weird it was. And you have to have your cash on you. When I say I don't want my passport on me, I mean it. It could be, I want my passport to be an NFT on the US government blockchain and call it a day. I don't need it destroyed or stolen. It's a pain in the ass. Yeah.
And by the way, with the rise of AI, as an example, can you try, video has been the ground truth of the internet. It's been the one thing you can kind of believe.
Of society. Yeah.
You can kind of believe.
Of society.
And now with deepfakes, can you still believe video? I mean, it's already the question. It's a question mark. And 3 years from now, by the way.
Oh, it's over.
It's over. And so one of the beautiful things you can do with the blockchain, I actually have a section on this. Actually, you inspired me on
Thank
that
you.
One because you've been talking about it.
Thank you.
And so it's one of the sections at the toward the end of the book. I go through a bunch of like application use cases. But deepfakes, so like a blockchain is a perfect way to keep an audit trail. And essentially, like, the New York Times can attest to, like, this video being real, and it's an immutable audit trail. That's a great... I think
it's
a great use for a blockchain. I think there's a lot of really interesting use cases for blockchains that are kind of counterbalances to what will happen with AI.
100%.
AI is also going to make, by the 100%. Way, content creation, like creating an illustration. It's already done this, essentially. It's going to be costless.
That's right.
Why is somebody going to pay an illustrator when they can do it through AI? Now, will that kill off the illustration business?
Like,
I don't think so. But I think they need to adjust their product.
Oh, it's huge.
And they need to start leaning into being communities and what you're doing, right? Like, because someone could generate a new image of a VFriend.
Correct.
And it's not going to matter to you because it's not the real VFriend.
Correct.
Right. You could explain. I should let you be doing the talking here.
No,
because,
brother.
But
listen,
like,
they
in
hear
the world
me
of AI,
all the time.
Like your business model becomes much, much more important in a world of AI,
of
I would
course.
Argue.
Of course. I, you know, we talked about this. We, you know, over a flight or a dinner, like the AI of it all. Is going to accelerate people's aha moment to the value of the blockchain.
Yep.
I mean, it's profound. And in a world where people are struggling with trust of big corporations and trust of government, like, it is actual human nirvana, decentralized place that shows
truth. How do you know it's a real person? How do you know, like, CAPTCHAs, you have to pick how many fire, click on all the fire hydrants, like, that's over. Like, the computer can do that.
I can't wait for that
like,
one to
the
be
computer's over.
Because,
gonna
by
write...
the way, I sometimes miss one. When I miss a caption, I have to do it again. I'm like, the bike was not really in the scene.
It's so absurd that we live in 2024 and that the answer to figuring out something is a human is, like, are there, like, how many bikes are in this photo? Like, it's just not the right answer to these problems.
No.
By the way, phishing, authentication, like, is this... I had one of my partners, he was tweeting about it, Martin, he had a one of his family members had a phone call with his voice with AI, using AI, and said, "Hey, I need you to send me money." And that's already here. I mean, you can take someone's snippet of their voice, and then replicate
call them.
It. Yeah, replicate it. So like, we're gonna need systems.
Yeah, imagine this. Hello, you know, and they got to take over your. No, you don't know the number, but a lot of people pick that up. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, they can
and it's
fake
like,
the caller
hey,
ID,
it's, I'm in big trouble. You need to text me. Like, it's gonna.
Yeah, you leave a voicemail so that
people are not
gonna
believe anything.
I think in a couple of years they'll have it interactive. Like, I can be speaking into the thing, and in real time it'll be making.
Yeah, I could be talking.
Yeah.
But it's we have that now.
Yeah.
For people.
So by the way, there's an answer to this, which is cryptography, right? Which
no
is
shit.
Cryptography on blockchains. You can have systems, build systems where you can. We have it. We walk
validation.
Around like we walk around with a you know with a touch ID in our pocket. And it's not that hard to connect that to a bunch of other systems, including blockchains, to make sure that we can authenticate video and text and voice and all these other things. And in fact, we have a bunch of, like, we were working with Sam Altman. He's got a startup called WorldCoin, which is exactly that, proof of personhood using blockchains, right? And so, like, there's a bunch of really interesting use cases. So I think the stuff in the book, you asked me in the beginning, what,
yes.
Why now? I think part of it's the consolidation of the internet. I think part of it is AI, which, look, I'm very bullish on AI. I think it's awesome. Our firm invests a lot in it, but it's a centralizing technology.
Yes.
It will reinforce the strength of these companies.
It's the extreme centralization.
Yeah.
It's a super powerful
thing, but it requires lots of data, lots of capital, lots of compute, and the big companies have that.
Yeah.
And it's going to reinforce that power, and blockchain, in my mind, is the one kind of credible kind of counterweight to that movement, and so it becomes more important than ever.
What have we not, you know, obviously, especially when we get together, we just went, like I knew we would.
I had coffee, Red Bull, I was like, I got to get Gary V level clock speed here.
No, you do just great yourself, brother. You need to be Chris Dixon out all the time. What did we not touch on in our ranting here that is either in the book that you'd like to make sure people know and or something that you just want people to know from this this interview? And one more time, everybody, if you're listening, I mean this. Open up your phone right now and go to your favorite bookstore. There's one or two at this point. Back to consolidation. Read, write, own. I just know my audience very well. I think I have a good track record with all of you of like books because, you know, I love when people get educated. I still think book form. When I think about your knowledge, because I know you from afar and now more and more close, when I think that that can be had on your opinion on this for $20 or whatever the hell this is getting discounted to on Amazon, that is profound. I still think books... are like the great knowledge.
I will tell you.
Do you agree with that?
Since,
by the way, I have a book coming out in May. Day Trading Attention.
I just ordered
it. Thank you. Thank you, brother. This is the secret of everything for me. Yeah. And I really did it.
You know, writing a book made me really appreciate books in a way. In fact, I finished the book basically in October. And I think I have read more books now in the last 3 months since because I because
you realize what you did.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, other people are doing this too.
Like, obviously, this isn't the full 25 years of knowledge, but it really is kind of the best parts of it. it's sort of like, and it took, like, I spent 12 months. I got up every morning. I spent 4 hours a day. I also had a lot of really smart colleagues who helped me.
It was work.
I didn't realize how much work it was going to be.
It was work for you. And by the way, this one was my hardest work too.
Yeah.
And I've written a bunch that have done really well. I think this one was work for you because you know it matters. You know that it's complicated, just like I know marketing's complicated. And you know that you've been fortunate enough to maybe be able to synthesize it. And that requires real effort because you can go long-winded here, you might miss something here, and there's a sense of responsibility.
Yeah, and look, I'll tell you too, so I started this after kind of the FTX and a bunch of the scandals and the other kinds of stuff. And at first I was sort of depressed. I was like, wow, all of this work over this stuff, and then these bad actors spoil it. And then I sort of said to myself, well, let's look at it optimistically, which is I've never been involved in I've been involved in technology a long time, but I've never been involved in one where the gap between the public perception and what I think is the reality is so wide. And instead of feeling sorry for myself that there's that wide gap, why don't I see it as an opportunity? Which is I could write the book to fill that gap.
Brother,
and that's what kept me getting up every day for a year.
Brother, honestly, you know this. Like, Bill Gates was the most powerful technologist of the time and was sitting on television making fun of the internet.
Yep.
Like, it's a fad.
Yep.
Like, back to Mark Andreessen.
You know, he wrote a book called The Road Ahead, which and it was came out in 95, and the word the web didn't appear.
Correct.
And so then he wrote a new version, and he bought up all the old versions so they wouldn't find them. You can find them on
eBay
now.
That's insane. Is that true?
Yes, that's true.
That's insane.
That's true.
This is why I don't like to predict. Yeah. I just like to talk.
And obviously he's a genius.
I'm not criticizing Bill Gates. I don't think that's
I'm making a point that it's very hard to predict.
What I'm saying is maybe this is the thing that has the biggest gap, but for the people that were fully bought into electricity when it was invented, obviously the person who invented it and the early believers of it, do you know how sad that first decade was when most of the general public thought that if you brought technology into your home, you were bringing demons into your home?
Yep.
Let me just, I've given you a lot of history lessons. Electricity, by the majority of the general public, was viewed as a voodoo spirit thing.
Do you know where the first electricity was in the United States?
It's right Edison, New Jersey.
No, well, that's where he was.
Yes.
But it was J.P. Morgan at his house where the library is today on 36th Street was the first house in the United States that had, he put a generator in the back. He wired up. He was a venture capitalist who ate his own dog food. He literally was the first person to have it. And it would smoke, black smoke everywhere, and all the neighbors complained. And then they went and wired up Wall Street. Yeah, no, but it was, of course, Thomas Edison.
No, of course, I heard now.
No, but he was the investor in it. But you're right, it was
like,
wild.
When
it
we
was,
sit here and we're like, oh man, I wish people understood the blockchain.
Yeah.
Fucking electricity.
But,
it's voodoo. It's gypsy.
There's a great book. It's like a cartoon book. I think it's called The War on Fun or something. And it's basically the argument is every single thing in the world at some point.
That's awesome.
It's first adopted by teenagers, and then adults hate it. And it happened with, going back to Socrates, he was anti-writing.
That's right.
The novel was originally considered
massive.
This debased, form of et cetera. The bicycle was very controversial.
The kaleidoscope.
The early cars, you had to disassemble your car. The red flag laws are called.
That's right.
Like, there's a long history of, by the way, early internet cryptography. This was a massive debate in the 90s. The 128-bit Netscape was classified as munitions by the U.S. government until 1999, I think it was. It was illegal to export 128-bit Netscape. They had a 32-bit version that you could export because strong cryptography was considered munitions, right? And people like Mark Andreessen, my partner Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, had to go in front of, down to D.C. and basically say, they would say, well, why would someone want to encrypt something unless they're a criminal? And they said, because someday, it doesn't happen today, people will buy things on the internet and they'll need it to be private. But that doesn't happen today. So, you know, you want us to make a law that allows for criminal activity when there's this thing that might happen someday? Like, literally, this was a major debate. People can look it up, the Clipper chip. Like,
I know.
It was a major kind of debate. I think of the blockchain debate today is similar to that.
I agree.
In that it's like this, you know, I think people will, someday when we're 80, as you were talking about, they'll be like, come on, no one was really against. They were really trying to ban blockchains and tokens? And they'd be like, yeah, they were. No, you're exaggerating it.
That's right.
I think that will happen.
Please, everyone, go out. This is as emphatic as I've been in the history of my podcast. This is a book you must pick up. I don't give a crap if you ever do anything on the blockchain or crypto. This is for life. This is understanding that history can show you the future and will make you more of a maybe person instead of a no person. And there is a direct correlation to professional success and spiritual, happy, personal success when you start eliminating no from your vocabulary and create maybe. Maybe leads to no, but no, but sometimes it leads to yes. No always leads to no, and it keeps you away from everything that is fun and good. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gary. You're the best. Thank you.